Welcome to the Suits and Sneakers podcast. Finally, fuck, it's taken long enough. This is where we break down and analyze the key characteristics of successful personalities from around the world. This is your host, Mark Shad. In this week's episode, I get to interview Kaya Blunger, a rather polarizing figure, and that's the exact reason why he's on this podcast. I originally started following Kaya a while back on Twitter because some of my friends would retweet his outlandish tweets and I would see them in my feed. Kaya is a very interesting character for me because he's everything that's right and wrong with South Africa at the same time. He came from nothing because the apartheid system marginalized his family, but through sheer grit and persistence, he rose to become a talented advertising exec who's now famous for having some really crazy abstract views about South Africa. All I can say is buckle up and prepare for a heart-wrenching story. The man has got some gusto. Hello, my little biscuit heads, and welcome to the Suits and Sneakers podcast. Once again, my name is Mark Sham. I'm your host. Today, I've got a really cool guest, another one of the Suits and Sneakers speakers, a man named Kaya Blunger. We are sitting here in a very bare version of my new co-working space, the Suits and Sneakers co-working space. It looks all over the show. Those listening won't be able to see it, but those watching any videos will. But I'm really excited. So, Kaya, first of all, thank you for being here, for taking the time, and welcome.
No, thank you. Thank you.
And I guess it's an interesting way to start that I like to start with all our podcasts is to ask this question point blank. I want to know what makes you get out of bed in the mornings. Literally, what is the thing that drives you on going straight to it?
Wow, all these bills to pay. You know, like, you know what? It's funny because maybe, you know, I mean, I've, you know, when you read motivational books and, you know, they tell you about like, yeah, you have to wake up and there's this great big thing that you're thinking about because you want to change the world. I think that when you wake up in the morning, a lot of the time, that is really not what you're thinking about. I can't wait to go and change the world. You wake up and you're thinking, oh, goodness. Let me get out of this bed. Let me go shower. And then I think in the middle of like you're driving a commute to work, that's when you start thinking about the things that you need to do that are bigger than you having to wake up, you know? So I'd say it's the bills.
It's a good way to start. And I guess the bills are totally relevant. And actually, it's a good way to start because it's one of the things I've actually really liked about you for quite some time. I've been following you on Twitter. And one of my interesting enjoyments of following you is that just every now and then you come out with these most random, well, not every now and then, actually often, these random spurts. It's almost like, I was like, I've actually been thinking that. I've just never written that. That's probably one of your great skill sets on social media. You have this way of articulating points of view that probably most people think about but don't mention in your day-to-day. What is your... Not that it's the most important thing to me. Yeah. What is your Twitter following sitting on as we speak?
I think it's just over 300,000.
Is it something you monitor? Do you care about it much?
You know, I think at the beginning, I mean, I did. I mean, I remember being, I'll never forget when I hit like 3,000. It was like such a big deal. I was like, I cannot believe that 3,000 people who want to see what I've got to say.
Yes.
You know, and then when it 10,000, and then for some reason, I think after about 20,000, I was like, whatever. And I don't know why. In fact, I remember when I hit 30,000, I was like, well, this is pretty cool. And then someone sent me a tweet and said, like, oh, congratulations on hitting 30,000. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. But I don't know. I didn't feel any particular way about it.
So I know obviously it's something that you've gotten used to.
Yeah.
But doesn't it still feel, not strange, but isn't it intriguing to you that you've got this big microphone just... Everybody carries their phone with them.
Yeah.
But on your phone, you're sitting with this massive microphone on the other end. I mean, of all the people I've spoken to personally, like in this regard, had a bit of time to sit. You're probably the person who's got the most followers that I've sat and had this kind of conversation with. And I've always wondered about the ability to broadcast to that big of an audience. Is it something that you think about regularly now?
It's strange. I think one of the things for me was it's how weird it is that people choose to follow me.
Yes.
And I've always found it a little difficult to unpack and understand why, you know, why that happens. But it's not something I think too much about, you know, to what I'll tweet. But I'll say it's literally, I think for me, I think about it as if I'm having a conversation with friends.
Yes.
And I am, whatever I would say to my friends, I would put out there. And also I enjoy conversations. I enjoy talking to people. So when, like, one of the things that I used to do a lot at the beginning was to, because I felt a lot of people were quite intimidated by, you know, getting onto social media and saying things. And I thought, well, what if I were to start asking people questions where there's no right or wrong answer, where you cannot be attacked for saying something? Because
yes.
That was the one thing that people were really afraid of. And, you know, I'd ask a question like, what is your school song? Well, most people had a school song. And most people would be nostalgic about that. And they'll think, oh, yes. And then they'll write the song and because they just remember. And then somehow I retweet it and they connect maybe with an old schoolmate they find on social media. So, and for me, it was really more about that. And so I still don't know why, you know, I have so many followers, but I don't have an answer.
It's something that I definitely want to unpack with you in a little bit.
Yeah.
For the next 2 seconds, last question around social media.
Yeah.
Do you know, give or take, how much you tweet during a day?
No. Sometimes I'll tweet 3 times in the whole day. Sometimes I will tweet 40-something. But it's been a long time since I tweeted, you know, that much. But it's just, it gets really hectic and really busy. So of course. I just...
Well, that was exactly why I was curious. Because I'm obviously prevalent on social media across the board.
Yes.
But the one thing I found quite difficult to do, with Facebook, it's easy to post once or twice a day.
Yes.
It's something you've been running. And you're not really encouraged to post about a million times a day on Facebook. But Twitter is a totally different game.
Yeah, it's because people are always talking to you. And, and like one of the strangest things at the beginning was when people, like, something would happen and I'd be working, maybe something happened in Parliament and there's some discussion and I was not aware of. And I go onto my social media and then I see someone saying like, oh, I want, like, oh, I'm just waiting to see what you have to say about such and such a thing. And so, and then I started wondering why, it felt weird that people were expecting me to have something to say about some incident or some event. And to see what my opinion was. So it was quite strange. And so as a result, you end up, because I like interacting with people, I end up maybe tweeting quite a lot because I'm responding to someone or I am retweeting something that they said to me, which I think I feel maybe other people need to hear it. And, you know, sometimes someone is attacking me for no reason. So, yeah, that happens. You know, it feels like, I always say that, like, Twitter sometimes feels a little bit like, you know, you're walking down on the street, minding your own business, and someone just punches you and runs away. That's what happens a lot on social media.
Yeah, the ninja behind the screen.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, that's very cool. You know, in anticipation of having you on, so by the time people listen to this podcast, the Suits and Sneakers main event would have already have happened. You and I are recording this before. Mm-hmm. But we're recording it so that once people listen to you on stage, if they want to hear more, they would be listening to this podcast right now. And so I've been doing quite a bit of research on you for these reasons. There's a booklet that's coming out on the night of Suits and Sneakers, and I'm putting like information about each of the speakers in there. So I wanted to make this look really cool. And it's always fascinating to do a bit of research about people. Now, I've got four very different and dynamic speakers there.
Uh-huh.
But it's very interesting what is said about you online, what's written about you. I read a lot of interviews, some stuff about books. Just fascinating. So I guess today we're going to answer a whole bunch of these questions, right?
Fantastic. Because
what I'd like to do is give people the information that probably wasn't available online. Because there's very dispersed amounts of information about you.
Yes.
There's stuff about you when you write. There's lots of stuff about you because you write lots of columns, which we'll get into in a little bit. But then, like, if I really want to know more about Kaya, I don't really get into it.
Yes.
So I think that this is the perfect example. So I want to kind of go all the way back.
Perfect. Right?
I want to hear who Kai is. Tell me like things like your earliest memories as a child. Give me an idea, if I've never met you before,
mm-hmm.
And anybody else, who are you? Where did you come from? Tell me about the early years.
Okay, the early years, geez. I was born in this really like tiny village in the Eastern Cape. It's just it's just, you know, out of this small town called Mount Aleph, literally. When I drive past Mount Aleph, which is near, not too far away from Croxton either, you literally can drive past and not even see that the town exists.
Okay.
Because it's not like one of those towns where you can drive through the town.
Yes.
Right? So it's the N2, and then literally there's like a little road, and there's a garage right next to it. So all your interaction with Mount Aleph might be because you just need some gas, and then you drive off, and you don't know that there's like an entire town that exists there.
Okay, wow.
So that's where I come from. And yeah, you know, it was like a really, it's a tiny village, and you know, it's got the huts, and you know, I slept in their hut. I was looking after my grandfather's cattle and his sheep, and I sent to school at a very young age by my mother, and a lot of the young men in the village had to come and work in Johannesburg. So they come to work in Joburg as miners and all of that. And so the village really had like young people and their children, women, old men. And there was a village because all of the men were in Joburg. And they'd come back once, like twice a year, around March for a week, December for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And so what they would always, and the women would always ask me to, once a week, there was a taxi that would come from Joburg to deliver letters from Johannesburg. And because I went to school pretty early and I was really young, the women would used to ask me to read the letters to them because they couldn't read, they were illiterate.
Oh, wow.
And then they would dictate the responses to their husbands to me, and I'd write, you know, their responses. And I always thought that maybe they did that because they thought I was young and I'm not going to be able to tell, you know, what they are saying to their husbands. I won't be like some SABC news reporter. So I grew up in an environment like that. And I think one of my earliest memories was when, father holding me. I was really young, and it's the only memory I actually have of my father. So he was holding me, and he was talking to my mother. I don't know what they were talking about, and because my mother was looking amazing and she was beautiful, and because she had gone to work in East London and my father had gone to work in Johannesburg, but he decided that he's not gonna, for some reason, stop looking, taking care of his family. So my mother was like, I'm gonna show him, I don't need no man in my life, I can take care of myself. So I saw she was this beautiful, like when she'd come to visit, I'd be so afraid of touching her because she was so this beautiful and gorgeous woman. I felt like I'd make her dirty. Now imagine if you're like this snotty nose, literally snotty nose child who looks like they've got kwashiorkor, and you are dirty in the village, so you kind of feel a little self-conscious. And I remember seeing my father standing there while he's holding me, and I felt like there's this insecure man, you know, it's weird, but he's holding me, but it's almost like he feels guilty for not being there. And I don't know how I pick that information up, but I felt that's what it was like. And then maybe about 2 or so years later, so I must have been 6. And my 6th birthday, so my mother has this massive 6th birthday for myself. And, you know, it was not my sister's birthday, but she had to make a birthday for her too. just to not, so that she doesn't feel left out. So she came from East London and had this massive birthday party for us. And my father, of course, wasn't there. And then on the, around 3 in the afternoon, some telegram kind of comes through. Everybody is called into a room, and then they get told that my father has died on my birthday. Oh. So literally from that day, my mother is not even 30 yet. You know, she's a widow, and she's got 2 children, and she's got to go and take it. And so that is really how I think, you know, my life really began, with my mother, who suddenly had to take care of this. She was taking care of her children anyway by herself. But I think it seemed even worse now that he was really absent for real.
Yes.
He was not absent out of choice anymore. Yeah.
No, there's no coming back from
there it. There is.
So when you were in Johannesburg and your mom was back in East London, where would you stay when you were in Johannesburg? Or who would you stay with?
No. I lived in the village.
Okay, so you I got that. You stayed there. It was just every now and then you'd come.
No. It was my father who was in Johannesback.
Okay, I'm back in the loop.
Yeah. So it was my father who was in Johannesback, and he lived in Johannesback, and he worked in Johannesback. I lived in the village, at Dugini, which is near Mount Aleph, and my mother worked in East London.
Okay,
so
I'm with you.
She left my mother, my sister, and I. My grandparents looked after us.
Okay.
So yes.
So I mean, this is really quite young. You're putting this at, you said six. When your dad goes. Yes. And so tell me about the age range from about that time, 6 to 13.
Yeah.
What happens in that time?
Okay, in that time, from about six. I think I'll never. This was probably the scariest moment. I think when I was about, it was about eight. So my mother decided to take us on a holiday. So she takes us to Durban. Get to Durban, spend like about a week, and it's fantastic, it's great. And she had a boyfriend now, and so he came along. And she had to, my grandmother had asked her to get some, you know, seawater, some salt water, because it's part of the ritual to cleanse your house, or whatever it was, right? And my mother is actually not superstitious at all, but she did it for her mother. And so we were standing by this embankment, so she kind of went down and went and stood by some rock, and as she was about to bend over to get some water, like this freak wave kind of comes and sweeps her over, and she falls on her back, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I think, and she, and as a foam washes over her, and I think that, oh my goodness, she's dead, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm like eight, and I climb down this embankment, and I just run, and I go to her, and she hasn't moved the whole time. And then I take her and I put her on my lap, and she's bleeding from the back of her head. And my hands are bloodied. And I keep saying, Auntie Vuka. I never called her mom because everybody called her auntie. And I thought that's what she was called. So I was like, Vuka, auntie Vuka, which is wake up, auntie, wake up. And then I saw this. And this was me not knowing anything about apartheid, whether apartheid was a thing or not. And so she is walking. I see this white couple walking past, and I say the only English words I knew at the time. It's just like, help. Okay, I knew help. My name is. What is your name? That was all the English that I knew. And so I'm like, help. I'm waving. My hands are blooded. And this couple look. They hesitate, but they carry on walking. And then another couple, a few minutes later, another couple walk past. The same thing happens. They don't respond. And eventually, so my mother, you know, she kind of starts moving and waking up. So when I was writing my book, so I told the story to her, and she was shocked that I remembered, which I don't understand why she'd be shocked, because it's so traumatic for me.
Yes.
And she says at that time, she remembers thinking that she is a widow, and if she dies now, who's going to take care of her children?
Mm.
Because she knows that, like, my grandfather doesn't really care that much about education, and my grandparents, or where she was married, no one really cared. So she literally says that she told herself she cannot die.
Wow.
So she literally told herself she cannot die. So she wakes up, and then she leans on me, and then we walk, eventually get there. But, and I mean, when I was like 9, 10, I was smoking weed in the village. Because it grew everywhere, and people always think that I'm joking when I say that I quit smoking weed when I was 10. And I am not. I was like, I'm done with it. I'm a veteran.
Jesus, that's hardcore. You win.
Yeah. So, and so, like, you know, this is the kind of life. And I was going to this school that was just terrible. And I was bunking school. So that I could go and smoke pot.
Oh my goodness.
So now I'm like 10. And my mother then, I think she sees the situation. And she thinks that if I don't take him to a good school, his life is over, basically. He's going to be like any other boy in this village. And so she decides to send me to the best school in the Transkei at the time, which was called Little Flower Junior Secondary School.
Okay.
And I couldn't speak a word of English. Except for, hello, my name is, you know, the typical. And when you first arrive in the school, so it's a Catholic boarding school. So when you first arrive in the school, they give you 3 months to learn to speak English, right? 3 months. So, and but month one, you can speak 90% Xhosa. Okay, you're allowed. Month two, say it should be about 60% English in your sentences. But month three should be 80 to 90%.
Wow.
And so you kind of have to start learning to speak very, very fast. Learn to speak English. Because now what used to happen, second term, and they find you speaking a lot of Xhosa. And since I was a boarding school, so the nuns would get like this masking tape and then put it around on your mouth, cover your lips for 3 hours. And if the 3 hours fell between mealtimes, you didn't eat. So it was a pretty good incentive to learn to speak English. So that's really how I actually, and until I think, and then when I was 12, I don't know how old I was, but then Mandela came out of prison, and then there's white schools are open, and then my mother sent me to some white school. So really that's what happened in that period of my life.
Okay, I mean, already I'm highly fascinated by that. You're an innate storyteller. It's in you. So you get to, at what point do you move from the Transkei? Give me some background. So, you kind of get into your teens now.
Yeah, so now my mother then decides to move me from the Transkei to East London. So I start going to this into white school, which is Hudson Park Primary School and Hudson Park High School. And in that time, I mean, we lived in this small, you know, the typical four-roomed house in the township. But we actually shared this house with another family. So the one family had the two rooms, we had the other two rooms. And our house was one of a few on the street that had no electricity and no running water. So you had to go around the back and all of that. So I went to this fancy school, this really good school with kids with money. But I lived a completely different existence, you know, from everybody. And I remember I used to be so self-conscious thinking that, like, because my mother would wake up in the morning and she would, you know, boil water like in the paraffin stove and also put it, you know, an iron and warm the iron on the paraffin stove so that she could iron her clothes. And I'd always be so self-conscious and I imagine like kids are able to smell that my clothes smell of paraffin.
Oh,
so God. It's weird, you know, as a kid, you imagine all these things
yes.
That are actually not real. And so what I did in that period is I consciously did not make friends because I go to this really rich school but I have this life, it seems very fake and unreal. So, and I don't want to make friends because then when I come to my house and if I come to, they'll see my house and then they laugh at me, you know,
yes.
That's how the thing as a kid.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
So, and then eventually, you know, I get to my matric and I actually don't study very hard when I was a matric because I'm thinking my mother doesn't work. How is she going to send me to tertiary? Because she doesn't have money. And I don't want to bother. In fact, like when we had to go to like Derby Days and go to another school, I'd never ask her for money. So I'd never tell her that. So I'd go into detention instead and never tell her that I had to go, you know, that's something I'm supposed to go and do. Because she doesn't have the money. Why would I do that to her? And so eventually, when I was in standard 8, we had this lady who came to my school to tell us about advertising. She was on the AAA in Cape Town. And then I was like, wow, this thing sounds so amazing. I want to do it. I totally want to do this advertising thing. And then from then on, I was like, I want to do this advertising thing. And then I lied on as a matric. I told my mother that I'd applied to the AAA. And so obviously the years keeps going, the months of, she says, but why have they responded? I was like, I have no idea. I honestly don't know why they haven't said anything. And then for some reason, a friend of mine had actually gone to Hudson, not to Hudson, to AAA in Cape Town. And he called the neighbors, right? Because we didn't have a phone. So we'd also go to the neighbors when the phone rang. My mother, I don't know who I was. The neighbor doesn't speak great English. So she heard someone talk about the AAA in Cape Town and then thought that they said that I should go to Cape Town to the AAA. So my mother then tells me this thing, and I was like, I can't tell her that I didn't apply. I cannot tell her this. So she scrapes like all the money she has, which is like $500. $500. I get on a taxi. In Tanzania, in the town, the township, all the way to Cape Town, where we almost died because the taxi driver fell asleep during the way. And so eventually, and in my mind, I'm thinking, what am I going to say when I get there? What am I going to say? Because the term had already started at AAA. So it had been a week. And I get there and I'm like, oh my God, So I devised this great plan. So I arrive, I get to the AAA, I've been showered, I've been in a taxi for like, I don't know, something like 14, 15 hours, and I get there, and I say to the receptionist, are they still accepting people? And the receptionist says, no, you're not my child. You trust me, you are wasting your time. Sister Andy, she says, you're wasting your time. Even the white children here came with their parents, and they were turned away. And how do you think you're going to be able to get in here? And then I'm like, oh, okay, but then she doesn't know my plan. So I say to her, well, I actually applied, but I never got a response. And she was completely stumped. She didn't know what to say. So she was like, oh, okay. So she goes and calls a registrar. And the registrar turns out to be the woman who 2 years ago went to my school and to speak about advertising.
Oh, wow.
And then she's there and she says, I don't understand. Like, I responded to everybody. So she says I should go to her office. I get to her office and she goes through these files and I'm like, I know you're not going to find my name there. So I know this, right? And then she says, okay, fine. I will give you these forms for you to fill in, but I'm giving you 3 days. Usually they give you like 3 weeks to fill these forms. So it's a freaking thick forms to get into AAA back in my day anyway. And so I end up staying with my friend. The entire weekend, I'm just going on this and I'm writing and I'm drawing and answering questions. And I must have slept maybe 2 or 3 hours the entire weekend. Eventually, the deadline was 12 o'clock and I was there at like 10 to 12.
Wow.
And then I've got, boom, she was having lunch. And she says, oh, you're here? I don't think she didn't think I was going to do it, right? So she's like, okay. She says, come back in 5 minutes. And then but it's impossible for her to finish this in 5 minutes. And I was like, she's completely decided she doesn't want me to come to the school. So I walk away anyway, come back. And in 5 minutes, she says, okay, come back in 10. But then again, she cannot be done in 10 minutes. And I come back in 10, and then she says, okay, please come back in 20. Eventually, I come back after 20 minutes. And then she says, she goes through my thing, and she says, I am really impressed. This is, wow, okay. Like, what if we want to accept you? How are you going to pay? Because you say your mother doesn't work. And then I said, wow, my mother has so many cows and sheep. So she's going to sell those, right? And she's got this property, you know, like, which is completely worthless, by the way. And they decide to accept me. And then I'm like, okay, great. And then I tell my mother. And then she actually starts selling the sheep and the cows that she had in the village to make sure that I keep going, you know, to the school. And then in my second year at the AAA, in my second year, she runs out of sheep and cows. And then I have to suddenly, and now I cannot eat, I'm staying with these friends of mine in this commune in Cape Town, and they decide, because for about a few months now I wasn't contributing, and everybody decides to go their separate ways. And then at this point, I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And then I end up sleeping on, literally, maybe it was like this. This flat was being renovated. So I end up sleeping in this flat that was being renovated. And when I get there in the evening, I'd remove the rubble, sleep, and then put it back together so that the guys work, they don't notice that there's someone who lives, you know, who sleeps there. And I'd taken my suitcase that I'd had, this one suitcase that my mother had given me when I came from, and she loved the suitcase from East London. I left it at the church. I'd asked them to keep this suitcase, to look after it. And then one morning, the guys who work there arrive too early in the morning. And I'm like, oh my God. So I literally just grabbed my bag. I slept my clothes on in case something like that happened. So I ran, I grabbed this bag, and I go through the back door, and I just run, and I run. And I'm thinking, how am I going to do this? And so, but I was still going to the AAA, even though I was homeless. So I used to forge this train ticket so that I could be able to get, you know, onto the train. Because on the AAA, obviously, I had all the equipment to do the forging. And so I would forge. And then so no one would notice that I had a forged train ticket. And because I was studying art direction actually at the time. So now I am at the AAA and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Oh my goodness, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then I decide, I have no option. I'm going to end up to sleeping on the desk of the AAA. So now I end up sleeping on the desks there. And so people would work late and I'd be so irritated because I want to sleep. Because I'm like, there's unwelcome guests, you know, they just don't get the hint. So I'd end up sleeping at the AAA. So this happened for quite a few months. And then one day, so every Friday, I used to go out and help at my church. They had like this youth group thing. And so I went to my pastor. So he dropped me off like around 10 in the evening. So one day he says to me, why am I always dropping you off in town at the AAA on Friday at 10 o'clock? And then I was like, phew, the deadlines, they are so hectic. So, and then he actually stops and he looks at me and he says, tell me the truth, what's going on? Then I break down and I start crying. And then I tell him what's going on. And then took me out of there and it took me to shame this poor couple who literally had been married 2 weeks before. And then they welcomed me into their home. And I was staying with them for about a month. And then I was at the YMCA. I had to drop out of the AAA because I didn't have money to carry on. And working as a waiter. So I'm just trying to skip through. Worked as a waiter. And one day, while I was working as a waiter, there's this guy, Warwick. And Warwick had an engineering degree. And he was always complaining about not having a job. And he's like, I don't have a job. And I was like, I think Warwick must have been like 26. I was 20, 21 at the time. And I'm like, but dude, like, you, why are you always complaining? And then one day while I was complaining, I was like, I don't want to be 26 and be complaining like Warwick, actually. I don't want to be this guy. So I decide I am going to apply for a job in advertising. And then I decide, I go and I start filling in this form. And not filling in the form, but I applied at the time. Low Bull Covered Pace was one of the most awarded agencies in Cape Town and one agency that everybody wanted to work for.
Okay.
And then I thought, I'm going to apply to go to that agency, this agency that no one, that everybody wants to go to. So I decide, I write in bullet point form. I said, I live in Pinelands, not Guguletu. I can use phones, faxes, and computers without breaking them. Some of my best friends are white. I am not a member of COSATU. And then I wrote in bullet point and another headline, and I said, position applying for, and I said, copywriter. Now, I studied art direction. I didn't even study copywriting. And then I wrote experience in this field, had another headline. And I said, I used to write slogans on township walls like Free Mandela and One Man, One Vote. This was a very successful campaign, as you might have noticed. So the funniest is I get this for the lady. When she calls me, she is canning herself. She's laughing and laughing and laughing. And she's, I'm so confused about this person on the other line. And she, I'm so sorry. I just saw your CV. It is so funny. Can you please come for an interview tomorrow?
Wow.
And that is how I got into advertising. And I think for me, the reason I actually wrote my CV though I wrote it was because I was like, number one, I'm not qualified. Number two, I'm this young black kid. Number three, the CV has to stand out. Yes. And it's got to show that I can do the thing I'm applying to do. Instead of saying that I went to AAA and I dropped out, but I'm very motivated. I'm very enthusiastic. For me, it was very important for them to see that I can do this thing. And I had to do it on that paper because it was my only chance.
Yes.
And that's how I ended up getting into advertising in Cape Town.
You know, I wonder so often about these situations because it sounds like a lot of this is innate in you. You know, you didn't finish your degree. You just kind of, from the thoughts in your head, this is what I've got to do. They called you in for the interview. Did you get the job?
I got the job. They called me for the interview. And when I went in for the interview, she said, yeah, great. This is because, I mean, I had my portfolio from AAA and she really liked my portfolio. She says that, and then she said, but she has to speak to the founder, was Matthew Bull, you know, owner of the agency. And then Matthew kind of told her that, but, you know, we can't afford to have somebody new here. Like, we can't. And then she said, you know what? I'm going to convince him to meet you, because once he meets you and he sees your portfolio, he's definitely going to hire you. So I go to meet him and he sees my portfolio and then he's like, okay, you're hired. So that is how I actually ended up getting, I got the job. And then got retrenched 9 months later.
Okay, well, let's go back there. Do you remember when you got the job, what the reaction was of your mom? Did you call her and tell her what had happened?
No, I shouldn't even tell her. You know, my mother found out that I was homeless and all of that last year when I wrote my book.
Oh, wow.
I never told her because I felt like if she knew, it would break her heart. But now when I'm fine, it's not going to be...
Yeah, now it's part of the story.
Yeah, it's part of the story, you know, because I didn't want her to feel guilt. So I don't remember calling her, telling her that I've got the job. I don't remember. That's such a good question. I don't remember. But I'm pretty sure I did, but I don't remember doing it.
Yes. I mean, I just think back now. I just listened to your background and your story. Mm. It's really the first time I've heard it.
Mm.
So I'm as much of an audience member for anybody else's who's listening to this. You know, I think about certain key points that really stick with me. The first time that black people were allowed to come to white schools.
Mm.
Because I remember that time I went to grade one in 1991.
Mm.
There were only white people in my school. I was 6 and 7. I didn't think about these things, right, as per usual. And then I remember my white teacher making a very random announcement at the end of the year or the beginning, like almost trying to give us the forewarning, hey, black people are coming. And this didn't bug me, right? Like, because I didn't know the difference. Yeah. And I was very lucky in that regard. I had a family who weren't, they weren't like, Mark, you've got to be careful now. Yes. You know, they were, they're black. Because let's call a spade a spade. Yeah. I'm sure amongst millions of white households, they were busy warning the kids like, you better be careful now.
Yeah.
And I remember black kids coming into the school and I wasn't excited. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah. This is what it is, right? It is whatever. But the one thing I'll never forget is... the teacher, my first teacher of grade 2, making this really shitty announcement.
Yeah.
You could see like total lack of enthusiasm, like, oh, I have to deal with this. Yeah. And that's something I remember.
Yeah, wow.
Do you remember, like, if you think about it, I had no context as to why she would just be acting like that. It's something that's very ingrained in my head. And now that I'm older, I understand that she was probably highly unimpressed with the fact that she had to have the job of teach black kids.
Yeah.
Because it was just not the way it was done. Do you remember in that time when you were going to a white school and you were suddenly allowed, do you remember what the reaction was like to you from other students, teachers, etc.?
In fact, like, funny enough, I went to 2 different primary schools ran by brothers, okay? So I went to this one, a Crewe primary school. So when I got to Crewe, that's the first school I was actually allowed to get in. I get into Crewe primary school and the teacher, Mr. You know, they say that I cannot go to standard 5 because obviously the education I got in the trans guy is obviously inferior. So yes, I have, obviously. And my mother says, you know what, it's fine. It's your way in. Once you're in here, maybe like in 2 weeks, they'll see that you know the work and then they'll take you to the next standard. And then I'm like, I play along. I get there. And literally, like the test that I get, I'm acing the test. I'm just acing them. And then my mother then says to me, okay, you know what? You go to the... Now, she tells me, a child, to go and say to this white man, you know, like white... Like there's no more... greater authority in South Africa at the time than a white male. So I go there and I have to speak to this teacher and say to him, well, you can see that I'm doing pretty well, so I must go to standard 5. I don't need to be in standard 4. So I have this meeting with the principal, and I tell him this. And he says, no, I don't care if you're doing well now. Well, we'll have to wait until next term. If you're still performing pretty well, then you have to go to, then we will take you to standard 5. And I don't know what made me think of this. And I said, but sir, that is unfair, because I will have to catch up on a whole term's work while still learning the new term. I said, well, the rules are rules. And then my mother yanked me out of the school so quickly. She was like, you're not spending another day in that school. And then we found another random school. It was also another white school, but it was a very random. But in the meantime, she kept looking for other schools. And then I ended up going to Hudson Park Primary, where the brother, he was the nicest guy. Like, he was incredible, Mr. Prentice from Hudson Park. And then, now, the one thing that I remember, I'm in standard 5, this kid, this Portuguese kid, takes Tipex. I'm the only black kid in my class. And I think in the school of 1,000, there are like 5 black kids. So he takes Tipex and he puts it on me and then says, hey, I'm trying to be white. Oh, you think you're white? You know, and I ignore him. He keeps doing that. And then he says, hey, Kefa, I'm talking to you. And then now he gets to me. And I'm like, I cannot believe he just said. So I lunge at him. But then the rest of the kids in the class, the guys, they hold me back. And I'm so mad. And then one kid, Darren, I'll never forget, he grabs me and he marches. For some reason, I don't know why there was no teacher in the class that day. He yanks me and he marches me out of the class. He's walking me towards the principal's school and I am crying. I'm in tears. He's marching me. He gets to the principal's office. He knocks, he opens the door, doesn't wait for an answer, and he just pushes me in. And then Mr. Prentice is busy having a meeting with someone. And so he sees me crying. So he ends this meeting. And then I go inside and he says, tell me what's wrong, what's wrong. Well, while I was walking, Darren says to me, we're going to report him. Because I thought that he was actually taking me to the principal for causing a fight, yes, you know, whatever. So I get there. And then I tell Mr. Prentice that, like, this kid called me a kefa. Yes, and then Mr. Prentice gets so angry and he calls Darren, says, go and call that boy, goes to call him, he arrives, and he says to this boy, what did he call Kaya? He says, nothing, sir. He says, so are you telling me that Kaya is lying? He's making this up. And then he says, no, sir. And then this kid was Portuguese. And then he says, do you know what Portuguese people are called when people really want to make them feel bad about themselves? And then it says, yes, sir. And it says, would you like me to call you that? It says, no, sir. And then it says, shake hands. Shook hands. And we actually became pretty good friends after that.
Wow.
So I remember that incident. But I also remember in school, when I was in high school, we're writing essays. So writing this essay with a substitute teacher and substitute English teacher. And it was after June exams. And so she said to me, so we had to write this essay, write it at home as homework. She marks us. And then she gives everybody back their book, right? But except for me. And I'm like, she's going to see me after class. I'm like, okay. And then she points to a word. What does this word mean? I tell her. This is my essay. What does this word mean? I tell her.
Oh, my goodness. She's testing you.
And then eventually I was like, excuse me, you didn't ask anybody else here. You didn't ask. She says, well, she first said, did you write this yourself? That's the first thing she said.
Of course.
And then I said to her, I actually got so angry. And I said, if you'd done your homework, you'd have seen that in June, I got the highest mark for creative writing. You would have known that.
Wow.
And then I just walked away. And I took my book and I walked away. And then she said, okay, what mark should I give you? I said, I don't know. And I walked away. And then from that day on, I refused to engage at all in the class. I did not engage at all. And so there were quite a few interesting incidents. But also when I was a kid walking around in the township from school, because people could recognize these school uniforms that only white kids used to wear.
Yes.
And they would literally stop me and they said, so can you speak English? Do the white kids speak to you? And then they literally, okay, speak English. And then you
go.
Yeah, yes, literally. I'm not even joking. And then you'd have like these grown ups, and they are like, oh my word, they're so fascinated seeing this child speaking English. It was such a big deal. Like one of the funniest things that happened, I broke my arm. I was running on the desk in school. I'm right. And I broke my arm. Then I had to go to, you know, our township hospital. So when I get there, and there were always white doctors, and the nurses were always black. And the doctor would always have a nurse who would translate for him. So I get there, my arm is broken, and then the doctor says something in English, she translates, and then I respond in English. Like, she's like, okay, maybe there's a fluke. Okay? And then she speaks again, she says something again in English. The doctor says something in English, she translates, and I respond in English. Wow. He's like, oh my, in Kosovo, which means like, oh my goodness, this child speaks English. Oh my God. And then she literally calls an entire ward of nurses. And I have maybe 20 nurses around me listening to this child speak English to a doctor. They couldn't believe it. So it's also a very weird time.
I listened to this background of yours, yeah, and it's so polarizing for me, yeah, if I compare,
yeah,
the background that I come to. Mm. You know, I mean, without going into it, I listen to these stories, and I think this is where so much of the disconnect happens. This is where people don't understand, especially when you're a youngster, you don't have the context you have now.
Yeah.
So a lot of these things happening to you, it's confusing. It can make you become very bitter. Mm. I mean, and it's good that it didn't happen that way, but like, you really don't. Let me talk on behalf of white people. I don't think white people sit and understand this. I don't think they sit and see all these. And I'm not trying to create the race divide.
No.
I'm saying me, yeah, because, you know, I listen to your background. Yeah. My background was probably the opposite. You know, sheltered, go to school. I'm a majority for a long while. Things go my way. I mean, I have a pretty easy upbringing. I didn't have rich parents, but I never knew. I mean, I just hear your stories. I never knew what that was like. I would have no clue. I didn't even know that could exist, let alone it happening to me. And you can live in such a cocoon. And, you know, one of the big reasons why Suits and Sneakers has become such an obsession for me. And when I say Suits and Sneakers, that all the things I'm trying to get toward, not the events. The big thing is that it's exactly, you've kind of proved the point that, look, I think that advertising and clearly education was in you. You had this ability from young, and it just worked out that eventually you got this gap. But it also still shows your mom was onto something, that education is the game changer in this regard. And if we're going to fix things for a country, not for everyone, you know, kind of you and not you, for the masses, we have to really rethink this whole education thing, because it's the difference between what you've become now and what you could, rightfully, your mom was right, what you could become staying in a village, cocoon in that space. The fact that you have all these people calling other people to say, listen to this kid speaking English. Just like, yeah, what a walk. Rightio, my little pop tarts. I thought we'd take a quick break from the podcast. I really just wanted to give you a little bit of information about what Suits and Sneakers has in store for 2017. We've been building for about 18 months, and I really believe that 2017 is the year we put our foot on the pedal. One of the new developments that we have that I'm the most excited about is a brand new event called the Real Life MBA. Now, this is an event that will be added alongside the main event that takes place in May. And the idea is, the very next day after the main event, we will be running our very first Real Life MBA conference. So the format would work something like this. Being that it's a full-day conference, there will be 7 time slots during the day, which last an hour long each. So as you can imagine, 8:30 to 9:30, 9:30 to 10:30, with some breaks in between and some lunch. Each talk is 45 minutes long, and then there's a 15-minute changeover time slot. The idea is that there will be 6 rooms with a different speaker in each room at each time slot. So our guests have to choose which one of the 6 talks they're going to attend at each time slot. Each talk is recorded, so even though the guests can only watch 7 out of about 40 talks on the day, they still get to watch the others online after the event. Each speaker will be aligned to a certain kind of theme, being leadership, entrepreneurship, marketing and advertising, finance, innovation, or abstract. And within abstract, you can have topics like health, wellness, politics, etc.
The idea is that our attendees get to choose their curriculum for the day, but still have access to all the other talks after the event via our online e-learning platform. This is something I'm really excited about because it becomes an event where you can pick your curriculum for the day. And there's some world-class speakers, the very best in South Africa, joining us. So keep your ears and eyes peeled for more information about the Real Life MBA. And that's it for now. I'm going to let you get back to the podcast. I hope you enjoy. How old are you now, as a matter of interest?
Jeez, I'm very old. I'm 36.
Nah, that's not old at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm 32. Okay, so I'm just trying to trying to put us. We're in not too different times, and yet we lived the most abstractly different lives to each other. And I really think there's value. One of the reasons I love podcasts so much, I really think there's value in people listening to these kinds of stories. Not to feel bad for Kaya, or just to get a perspective of, good God, that wasn't my life.
Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, very interesting to hear all of this. You get your shot at the advertising agency. You told me that you get retrenched 9 months later. What on earth got you retrenched?
No, the company, literally, they lost a big piece of business. Like, I think within 6 months of me being there. And then I was like convinced I was going to be retrenched in that first round of retrenchments. And I didn't. And then they lost another piece of business. And then I got retrenched. So... And then I'll never forget being called into the office by Matthew to tell me that I'm one of the people who'll be retrenched. And then he says, how does that make you feel? And I said, I'm actually quite relieved and I'm happy. And he says, what do you mean? And then I said, because I was like, well, because I feel like no one is teaching me anything. I feel like I'm actually on my own. I'm not being mentored. I'm just, no one actually cares. So maybe where I go next, I will make sure I have someone who is there, you know, mentoring me and teaching me whatever needs to be, I need to be taught. And that was why. And then he was so angry. He was like, I hate hearing that because it means we're not taking care of people.
Yes.
You know, so really, then actually the next agency was Ogilvy, Cape Town. I was at Ogilvy, Cape Town. I was there for a year. And then I left Ogilvy because I felt like I was a number, you know. And then I went to the Jupiter Drawing Room where, in my interview, it was fantastic. I was being interviewed by a gentleman called Graham Lang, who did not ask me anything about my work, but because it already, obviously, I think it's in the work. And then all he asked me was like, what do you think about South Africa? Where do you think the country is going to go? How do you see it? And I think what he wanted to see was my philosophy as a person. Yes. And whether the philosophy, because I suspect he felt that you... If you have an innate philosophy, there's a certain kind of work you'll be able to create because you believe in something. Whereas if you don't believe in anything, then you won't be able to create great work. I imagine that's what
that
he
makes
was
perfect
doing.
Sense.
Yeah,
to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, wow. So Ogilvy to Jupiter Drawing Room. How long were you at Jupiter for?
I was at Jupiter for 3 years, and at the time, I remember being there for a month, and in that 1 month, I created more work than an entire year of figure at Ogilvy. And it was just amazing. And I was just getting all these briefs I was doing. I got like my ad of the month within the first, my first week of, first month of working at Jupiter. So, and I won a lot of awards while I was at Jupiter in those 3 years. So like Musica, Nando's, Virgin Money, Hyundai. I was working on some pretty, you know, pretty decent clients. So I had a good time when I was there, a really good time.
Yeah, I don't want to harp on the heartstrings. I'm just so curious about this relationship between you and your mom. So when you've gone from the first advertising agency to Ogilvy, then to Jupiter, what is the relationship like now? She obviously knows that you're doing these things.
She knows. Yes.
Because
at the time, I mean, I was speaking to her every single day on the phone. I was calling every day. Yeah.
And she must have been so excited for you.
Well, I think it's hard for her because I don't think she understood what advertising is.
Yes.
I don't think she even understands what it is now, but I think she just is happy that I'm doing something.
Yes.
When I tell her something, I think she knows that she needs to feel proud, even though she doesn't quite know.
That actually makes sense.
You know, it's like, actually, I think I should feel proud.
It's a little bit like mom, I'm opening a co-working space. Lovely boy. You could just see her running around the corner going, what's co-working? We're talking about informal education. It's like, just so, I can,
I can relate to that. Yeah. So, I mean, these are really interesting moves. You're starting to move now. This is all happening in Cape Town. I assume that Jupiter was in Cape Town.
Yes.
What, because I'm really just fascinated by your story. At what point do you make this migration from Cape Town to Johannesburg?
You know, it was so funny. Like, I used to, I had these friends, right? I was looking at this picture and everyone was always complaining about Joburg, Cape Town Center. If you're a black person, you reach a ceiling in Cape Town and you can't go any further. I was like, you know what? You guys are talking crap. You know what? I'll be fine. You guys can go to your Joburg. I will prove to you that I can make it in. And then I looked one day and then I looked at this picture. All my friends are gone. I was the only one in Cape Town. And then I remember saying to them, you know what, I actually want to do something that they think you can't do as a black person in Cape Town. And then I was like, I will try and win an award while I'm in Cape Town, like a major award. And then I won, I won a Ken Gold. And then there was like, I was like, okay, I've done it. Now I can leave Joburg. I can leave Cape Town. Because I felt like I needed to have something in order for me to move to Joburg. Because it's like, it's a big fish out here. I need to have something. And so when I moved to Joburg, I went to Black River Football Club, which was an agency that was started by the Jupiter Drawing Room Cape Town. And I was there for a year. And then I left and I went to Metropolitan Republic with Paul Warner. I was there for 3 years. And then Coca-Cola just happened to be looking for... Because I was working as a copywriter. And then when I was at Metropolitan Republic, I said to Paul, I want to work as a strategist now. I don't want to do this copywriting thing anymore. And he says, okay, sure, fine. But he said, because I actually negotiated with him, at the time, I don't think he knew this is what I was doing. So I was offered a raise, okay, this 1 year. So I turned down the raise and I said, no, thank you. I don't want the raise because I don't feel like I've done work that is good enough. And it is true. I truly felt that the work I did was not good enough. I felt like I'd be getting it. I'd be getting it. But I felt like I would be encouraging myself to create mediocre work. And so, and then...
But Kai, I just want to stop you there.
Yes.
You got to know that at the time, that is a totally abstract and, you know, opposite way of doing things. It's definitely going to get attention. Did you realize... I mean, I believe you. Sitting in front of you now, I believe that you looked at him and said, listen, I haven't done the work to justify the raise.
Yes.
But you've also got to know that that must be, if not impressive, it's got to rattle his cage.
You know, like...
I mean, did you know that that was...
No. I didn't know that it rattled his cage. But I think, for me, it was more about me.
Yes.
Because I was actually disgusted in myself. Because I was so used to creating good work.
Yes.
And this year, I had nothing. So I was used to it. So it was like, it was this foreign thing to me that like not having, you know, really good work. And I was used to it.
It's just an out there thing to say though. I mean, as an employer, I love it. I love it.
Yeah. But I was like, at the same time, I was like, I walk out there and I'm such an idiot. I'm like, what am I thinking? I am broke as we speak. And I'm saying I don't want to raise. Wow. You know, so I'm thinking about that. And I'm like, so I'm thinking I'm regretting this decision, you know. And I walk out. It's not because of some moral compass I had.
Yes.
It's just that I felt like I would not be driven if I accept this thing that I don't think I deserve.
Yes.
So, and then like about 2 months or so later. So, like, by the way, the next day, so he comes into my office. He says, in my 20 years of advertising, I have never... met someone who has said no to a raise or even heard from someone who's turned down a raise, right?
Even if you didn't mean to, which is even more impressive, actually.
Yeah.
If you weren't doing it to kind of strategically, which I agree with you, I believe you, then it's even more impressive in a way, because I know as an employer, I'm an employer.
Yeah.
If someone... That work ethic is right.
Yeah.
I've never heard of someone saying, hold on.
I was like, no, thank you. I don't, Anyway, I'll never do it again.
The bills.
So now, and then I was like, I want to be a strategist, actually. And then I decide, I'm pretty sure because since I turned down that raise, I'm pretty sure he'll say yes if I say, can I be a strategist? So I go to him and I ask him to be a strategist. And he says, are you sure? Like, yeah, yeah, I sure. Yeah. And eventually, and every single day he'd come into my office and be like, do you hate it yet? Do you hate it yet? You know? And I'm like, no, no, no. And I actually did hate it. because I was doing this mundane work. It was so mundane. And I was hating it. And then we happened to be pitching like on FNB. So we're pitching on FNB. And the head strategist is struggling to explain to the whole agency where she wants them to go. But meanwhile, I'd been working on a different strategy that I thought, because I didn't quite agree with where she was going. And I had this alternative strategy that I was working on. And then when I saw this riot in the boardroom, so I called Paul and said, listen, I may have something I've been working on. Can I show you and the head of strategy? And then I show them, and then he's like, yeah, okay. You know, I can see he's just desperate at this point. He's like, okay, whatever, right? This is okay, I'm just... Then he calls me to present. I present to the whole... After I'm done with my presentation, advertising people are very cynical. So they applauded. I was like, wow, okay. Yeah. And then we pitched, won the business. And then it comes to me after I've done the thing. He walks into my office, closes the door, and he says, you know, when I said you made a mistake, I think you're born to do this.
Wow.
And then he got up and then he left. And that made me feel so good. So, but because he gave me, like, I don't think that most people would have actually given me the chance that he gave me, you know, to get away from the job, you know, from, yeah, anyway, yes.
Okay, I mean, that's it. Okay, well, okay, so yeah. Cola swings by to you. Give me the, because I'm going to get back into these bits and pieces, but give me some paraphrase. Why did they come to you? What did they want from you?
Oh, okay. My cousin happened to work at Coke, and she was a lawyer. And there was this role which did not exist, content excellence. So it never existed. And then she told them about me, and they asked for my CV. And I sent the CV. And so the lady had actually been asking around, you know, about me anyway, apparently, by the time she got the CV. And I went for the interview, and they said they were looking for someone with a creative background and a strategic background. So that's what they were looking for. How many people in the country had that, you know? And I happened to be the right person at the right time, just for that kind of role. And that's why they called me. And I remember I had like 6 interviews. Oh my goodness! And I had all the 6 interviews. Finally got the
blood tests,
including everything. And including speaking to on the phone and having this altercation with the global vice president for content excellence, where I told him that I didn't like some ad that he'd done during the interview. I didn't know he'd done this ad, and I was like. At the end of the interview, like, I don't have this job, whatever. It's like, I didn't want it anyway, you know? You know when you try to convince yourself, stuff like that. Perfectly. So I'm doing that. And then, you know, I got the call that they want me for the job, which was great. And yeah, and it took me a very long time to actually get into the swing of things because I came from just a corporate. I'm the only creative person in the age. It was very strange. And this role did not exist before. And there are people who are doubting whether I need to be, my existence can be justified. And even me, sometimes I wake up in a state of panic in the mornings and I'm like, what did I forget to do today? Oh my God, what did I forget to do? And it was very strange. And I think it took me a good year, 18 months to actually get into the swing of things. Yeah. But once I got into it, it was just smooth sailing from there.
Yeah, I think they could afford to give you your 18 months at Coca-Cola. Okay, so how long were you at Coca-Cola all in all?
I was there for almost 6 years. And it was an amazing run because, I mean, some of the smartest people I've ever met and I've ever had to work with. And in terms of marketing, I would say unrivaled in terms of what you learn, you know, from them. And how you get challenged and who challenges you. And I think I was very lucky in the sense that everyone kind of just accepted me for who I was. I was a little different from everybody else. I come dressed how I want. I went to the office dressed like how I wanted to get dressed when everybody else was very corporate. And so, I mean, from the day one, so everyone's like, okay, fine, we'll just let him be. He's a creative guy. And in that time, I was at Coke, we literally, I mean, Coca-Cola South Africa hadn't won that many awards in terms of advertising. By the time I'd left, we were well over, I don't know, so, I mean, my agency, they keep telling me that the old agency that, you know, worked for us when I was at Coke, that we had in total of over 40 odd awards that we won in the, like, including like five Cannes Lions and New York Clios, one shows, DNADs, like any major award you can think of, you know, we got them. So that for me was pretty great, because one of the things that I had told myself when I said, when I leave Coke, I want to have left a legacy. And I want to have raised the bar. And I think that, you know, the bar was raised. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has actually got to do with the right people you work with. And a lot of people think that it is individual brilliance. It's never individual brilliance. It's like, it's all the stars aligning together, but you also actively making sure that they align. So it was about getting, like, I had a great relationship with a guy. It's a long story, which one day I might get into, where I had an altercation with this global, you know, global VP. And then I ended up having an amazing relationship with him. And then from there, I did this incredible relationship with a marketing director and a great relationship with the ad agency. So with all of those, and also an amazing relationship with the Coca-Cola team, the marketing team. So with all of those things gelling and working together, you are bound to create great work.
Yes.
But, and a lot of people think that, like, I should be the brilliant one, but it doesn't work like that. No. You need lots of people to make all the brilliant things happen, because no one does a great thing by themselves. It is impossible.
So it's a very random on the topic / off the topic question. Yeah. If I say the name Neville Isdell, does it mean anything to you?
Neville Isdell. Dreadlocks?
No. Yeah, it's actually just interesting. He was the former...
Does it have dreadlocks?
No. Okay. In fact, I'll tell you why. I'll give you the context. Yeah. He was the former CEO chairman of Coca-Cola Worldwide.
Yes.
But he had a very... I have my own interesting relation to him, because... he has a book out, Inside Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Which I read about 4 years ago.
I still haven't read it. I've got it. I feel terrible.
Good book. Read it. Yeah. Loved it. Started doing book reviews about the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it eventually culminated in him and I bumping into each other randomly in Joburg one day. Wow. And he doesn't live here.
Yes.
And I begged him to come back to South Africa. And long story short, I eventually got him to come back and I ran an event with him in Cape Town.
Wow.
3 years ago. And so Coke has always been such a fascinating brand, because I just love, he told me all these inside stories about his time at Coca-Cola, even little things that weren't in the book. It was always so fascinating to hear. But the one thing he did was he loved the brand. He always spoke well about the people.
Mm.
That's what made me think about it.
Yes.
You know, he always, and he actually spent about 10 years here in South Africa, but it might have been, well, it probably was before. I think he was in the late 80s into the early 90s he spent his time at Coke. But he still comes back to Cape Town probably once or twice a year. Him and I still keep in touch. Mm. It's just so interesting to hear a lot of different people talk about Coca-Cola. So what makes you leave Coca-Cola?
I was not growing anymore. And I felt that I was not being challenged. I felt like I knew my job, you know, like the back of my hand. And I think for me, there's nothing worse than not growing and not feeling like I'm being challenged. And I remember saying to... You know, because it was very strange when I resigned. Oh, wow. I'll never forget getting this phone call from, an email from the head of legal. And she says, you've got to come to my office now, go to my office. And the first thing she says to me, this is the sweetest lady. She says, Kaya, what the fuck? And so I tell her, and I said, I don't feel like I'm being challenged anymore. I don't feel like I'm growing. And I said that, you know, to my marketing director, a lady I respect and love so much, because, like, truly, I think without her, I would not have achieved half the things I achieved when I was at Coke. And then with the CEO, former CEO now, who's since left, Therese, and I said the same thing to her. I was like, I'm not growing. I'm not being challenged. And I don't see where my path is. So if it was very clear and said, this is the path, fantastic. You know, but right now, I'm not saying it, so I have to go. And I would like to be afraid again. You know, when I arrived at Coke, I was terrified. I didn't know what I was doing. I was so scared. And I felt like I was screwing up every single day. And I was just learning. Like, you know, once you thought you knew something, tomorrow, you realized how much of that thing you didn't know. Yes. And literally, for over a year, that was what I was experiencing at Coke every single day. Because there was so much information, so much, you can do this, you can't do that. You can do that, even though you can't do it, because it was insane. And then I was like, I want to do something that I'm afraid of, something that scares me, that I feel like I'm in danger of being fired every time, you know. And then when I left and I went to, I said that when I was approached by you know, Heineken South Africa, and I basically said that, I've never done this kind of job that you guys are asking me to do. I'm not great when it comes to spreadsheets. I don't do them, and literally, I think I said everything to them that could make them not hire me. And then for some reason they felt like okay, the general manager was the CEO. CEO of Heineken South Africa basically said to me, Coca-Cola would not have clung onto you for 6 years if you were terrible at your job.
Which is bigger.
So, because he's like, because I know Coke, I've dealt with Coke, I know what the business is like. So, anyway, and then, yeah. So
how long have you been there for now?
Now, since March. How many months is that?
Yeah, it's about 7-8 months.
Yeah, 8 months. I've been there for 8 months now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you still feeling a little scared?
Yes. I mean, I'm like, the alcohol business is very different, you know, because at Coke, I was not just working on Coca-Cola. So I was doing communication strategies, the advertising, all the comms across all of the brands. So there are 26 brands, but then obviously there were 14 active brands. So there were 14 who I was actually working on regularly.
Yes.
And then here, I work on purely on Amstel. So this is literally like everything. It's narrowed down like this.
Yes.
Every single little kind of thing that has got to do with Amstel, I have to deal with. So if it's the cap, I have to deal with the legal stuff that is written on the back of the thing. Like, you know, the all communication baby, strategy, yeah. And I was sponsoring this event. No, I would, you know, like all those kinds of things. That is my, I have to deal with all of that, which is very different from me just purely focusing on communication when I was at, across all those brands.
So I want to shift gears. I think it's really interesting to hear where you've come from, and I want to applaud you. I'm not just saying that. I just listen. I often wonder, you know, people are so much a product of their environment. So I'm always amazed and really intrigued by people who supersede their beginnings, their, you know, I guess, for example, a question that I have is, where did your penchant for the style come from? Because you come from a village, right? You do this thing, and then, like, when you go back home, do people look at you and go, who is this fucker? Is this the same guy?
That's funny.
So you know, give me a 2 minute.
Actually, you know what? My mother loved fashion.
Okay.
And even says, there's this picture that I found of her, and she's holding like a tray, and she's in the village. She's a young girl. She's in the village, and she's got sour milk in a jug, but she's dressed to the nines, and she's posed, she's got the shades, and I'm like, but this doesn't make any sense. Like, you're in a village and you dress like you are on the cover of Vogue or something, you know. That's, I'm not even joking, that's what she was like. And she loved, and she used to dress me up as a child, even when she had nothing, because she felt that even if you are broke, you don't have to look like you are broke. You don't have to dress like you don't have to represent yourself that way. And I think for her appearance was quite important. And I do suspect that in some way I probably picked that up without being aware that I picked that up.
Because you're definitely a stylish fucker now. Every time I say, the one thing you've got, if you go Google search Kai Langer, you'll get an idea. The one thing you will know is that he digs to dress up. He likes to look the part. Yeah. So I want to shift gears with you a little bit and just ask you some questions that are near and dear to my heart as we kind of begin to wrap up-ish. Obviously, this being the Suits and Sneakers podcast, you know, what we're trying to do is disrupt education. It's a... When I listen to stories exactly like this, I love hearing that you made it through, but it bugs me. It shouldn't be like that always. And that's cool. I think that people learn from tough. It's cool when they get out from it. But until then, you know, there's so many people who miss shots and miss opportunities. I don't know what it is about you that you clearly have some resilience in you. You know, what I'm picking up from today's story was that even when you were staying in the little room that's being renovated, you didn't have this pity party. It was just, you were very pragmatic. Where to from here? What do I do next? What's the next? And some people don't always have that. It's just not built in them. And that's oftentimes that one little thing drags people down. And I think that if we could be leveling the playing field with more education, I think it starts all there. So these days people know you because you are quite outspoken on social media channels. You have a lot to say about our country, and I think quite rightfully so. I think you are an intelligent voice on the matter. You come from the other side of the coin. How do you feel about South Africa as we speak? How do you feel about the, not just government, because I think people are generally annoyed. How do you see our future? How are we going to pick ourselves up from where we're at? Like, give me, when I say South Africa, what comes to mind for Kai Langer?
You know, like, I mean, like the last column that I wrote, I think one of the first lines I said, it is a miracle that we as a country are still standing and functioning pretty well despite our leader. And that is a testament, I think, of the people of the country and maybe the institutions and all of that. So I think that I have a lot of hope, I think, in this country. And I really do feel that we are one of, I feel that if we are performing the way we are, despite what's happening, can you imagine if we are being run well, what would happen to the country? And I do think that this is probably the darkest day since democracy that we will be experiencing as a country. And I think from here on, it can only get better. And I am very optimistic, I think, when it comes to South Africa. I don't think, I mean, I've visited a few countries in the world and I've had no desire to stay in any of the countries that I've been. I'm talking about first world countries. This country for me is just absolutely fantastic. I think, you know, like a few years ago, there was a former US ambassador, Donald Gibb. This guy was like in the room when Obama decided to run for the presidency the first time around. And so, I asked him, like, why did you choose to come to South Africa as an ambassador? And he goes on, so he tells me this story that, you know, when he worked in the Bill Clinton White House, and then then the Bush years, and then became completely disillusioned with politics, left politics, went into the technology industry. And then when he heard Obama speaking in 2008, so this guy's amazing. Who is this guy? He's incredible. I really, wow, this guy. Crawls around, he says, spoke to a friend of Obama's. And this guy says, is this guy for real? And then Obama's friend says, he's even better than he sounds. And I was like, wow. So he ends up working for him. So he raises money for him. And then the day Obama then decides to run, he says, great. Okay, he's one of the people in the room. Which means that now he can choose any country he wants to go to. Could have chosen China, could have chosen India, could have chosen England. He says the reason he chose South Africa is because South Africa, for him, is the most creative country in the world. But we as South Africans don't know how to harness that creativity. we don't know what to do with it. And that was the only reason he chose this country. And because he also feels that creativity has the capacity to probably just transform a nation and communities and all of that and economies. And he says, we've got it. We just don't know how to harness it. And I believe that.
Yeah, I would say I share your sentiment. You know, it is, you're actually right about this. When you look at the way South Africa is operating in spite or despite of leadership across the board.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And it does show you there's a remarkable resilience amongst its people. We are learning. We don't come without our faults. But there is a shared sentiment. Because for the first time, South Africans across the board are united on this front. We want things to be better.
Yeah.
And I think we realize over long patches of time that lack of unity goes a long way in destroying that. And race is a real thing. There's no question about it. When you, for even this reason alone, if you just take just the way you and I were grown up, so, brought up so differently, there is. There's a chasm between the way you were brought up and the way I was. I don't understand your life, you know? And I can understand how other people wouldn't understand mine. I can understand where resentment comes into it. I can understand a lot of these things.
What the differences? It's quite interesting is that, like, I think black people understand white life a lot more than white people understand the black
question.
You know, the black life, because it's like, you know, you sit on TV, you read about it, you encounter it. For me, like going to school. You know, I was going into a white life, like every day, that's what I was doing. But then I had to go back to my black life every day. Yes. Whereas like white people, you just
stay in your
white life. You just have to stay in your white life. So you don't need to understand, just, you know, and all of that. There's never a requirement for you to go into the other. Yes. And I think for us, it was always about, in order for you to survive, to thrive, you need to understand this other life. Because it is this side that has the money, the resources, that can give you a job. And the other side, you know, you're like, as white people, like, I don't really need to go to cross that bridge because what has it got to offer me? And I think that's what the chasm has been.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you. And I'm not just saying this, I often sit up at night thinking, how do we fix this? Because if people just understood, that's why, for example, white people don't necessarily always understand, and I'm generalizing here a lot, but a lot of white people don't understand that white privilege, for example, in my opinion, is a very real thing for the reason that you're saying, because I can stay in my white life, right? So my domestic worker has to come, for example, she comes and works into my world and then she leaves, but I don't have to go into her world.
Yeah.
The most I have to think about it is when I drive, and I'm being facetious, when I drive past Alex or I go into a township, that's when I have to think about it.
Mm.
But it's really out of sight, out of mind. I go in, depending on the type of person you are, you feel bad, and then it's totally out of sight, out of mind again.
Mm.
But the one thing that's always stuck with me is we don't realize, as white South Africa, how much it's actually hurting us. We don't get it. And so, again, part of what I've been always trying to do with Suits and Sneakers is create that education, bringing people together, getting people to understand new perspectives, etc. You know, it's not just about having Kaya Dlanga on a stage because we need a black face, you know. It's so fucking retarded. I'm beyond it.
Mm.
Okay, so I love to hear that you're positive about South Africa. And on that note, what are the things you love about South Africa? Tell me about when you think about South Africa and you feel good.
Yeah.
What are the things you love about South Africa?
You know, I think there's so many things. You know, it's interesting. You know, I feel like when I travel, you know, and to say you're from South Africa, people are actually quite curious. You know, and I don't know why, they're just very, and I suppose it's the history and all of that, they're just very curious about it. And I also think one of the greatest assets that we have, and unfortunately, a lot of people don't take advantage of this. We are an extremely diverse country, probably one of the most diverse in the world. So we have a massive Indian population, a sizable Chinese population, sizable white population, Jewish population. You count it, Nigerian. We are a melting pot. And I think as a result, we probably had such an advantage of learning about other cultures without having to go there first. So if you need to travel, because you get a sensitivity towards people who are quite different to you. There was a certain stage where South African executives were quite sought after globally because of their ability by multinationals, because of having to deal with different cultures every day. And I think we underestimate that point about us as South Africans. And I also think, for me, what I love about us as a country is also the fact that I think we are actually unafraid of tackling really difficult subjects. You know, right now, the thing about Fears Must Fall, it's an incredibly difficult subject. It's an incredibly challenging subject, but it's got to be dealt with at some point. And, you know, like these past few years, I think this dialogue about racism and race and all of that has been very, like, on the forefront, I think, of South Africans. And when you look at countries like the States, where you think they should be so advanced, and those, they're quite behind, I think, in terms of how we're so openly discuss these matters. Yes, we don't come to a solution and a proper conclusion, but we're able to tackle really tough subject matters. And I think that also what I do love, I'm trying to think what is another thing that I love. Because it's so much, there's so much stuff that I love. But I honestly think that we, I'm pretty sure everybody in any country probably says that we live in the greatest country in the world. But I sincerely think we do.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's so much that we can explore. There's so much I haven't touched in. But for time's sake, I'll pretty much have to wrap up. I'm trying to keep it within that time frame. So I have two last questions for you. The one is an easy one to ask. Maybe not so easy to answer. Where do you see yourself, I don't know, 5-10 years? Wow. What does that roadmap look like for Kaya Dlanga?
I have no idea. And I'm not even being modest, whatever. I honestly don't know. There's a thing that I love that Woody Allen said. So it says, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
That's actually great.
Because
they're going
to
change so much.
So honestly, to be honest, like 5 years ago, I didn't know that I'd be working where I'm working. I didn't know that I would have written the kind of book that I wrote. And I think some people, they need to have that plan, to create the plan, because that is how they are made. That is what is in their nature. And some of us, we have to respond to what the universe is saying every so often. And I think I'm one of those people who has to respond to what the universe is directing me towards. So that's why I can't say that this is my plan for the next 5 years.
Well, I think your saving grace is that you've got great response mechanisms. So whatever comes your way, it seems that you clearly have a head on your shoulders and you'll go from place to place. And what I'd like to do before I ask this last question is, I think that we have to have a round two sometime. It's the same thing I said to Ron, because what this podcast is going to do, you know, it's so much fun for me to have these podcasts because I get to learn so much. I'm an avid learner. So I definitely think we have to do a round two in a few months when this thing's a little bit more developed. Because I want to hear, there's so much I want to hear about your books and your time at Coca-Cola, what you're doing now. There's so much. But I think the question that I love to end this podcast on is one that's near and dear to my heart. So it's going to go something like this. I want you to pretend that I, as Mark Sham, I could gather every single South African into the biggest room possible. Okay, I could get every South African in this country to quieten down for 5 minutes, and I could get them to give you their full attention. So you walk up on the stage. I know. You walk up on the stage. You've got every South African listening to you, right? The microphone is all yours. You've got their full attention. If you had to, on the fly, tell them something. You've got everybody. What do you say to South Africa?
That is so intense. Oh, my goodness. It's going to sound so lame. But I think this is what I would say to South Africans. I think that you are probably one of the... have the greatest gifts in the world out of any nation. And not just the natural resources, but in terms of the spirit of the people. And I think that you as a people, as South Africans, can have an outsized influence on the world in terms of whether it is the economy, the things that you're running, in terms of creative arts, in terms of a contribution in philosophy and policy discussions in the world. And I honestly, all it takes is just for us to actually just focus and make it happen, because I sincerely think that as South Africans, as a small country of, you know, just over 50, 55 million people, we definitely can have a ridiculously outsized influence on the world. Like, you know, like more so than a small country like Japan, but it's got millions, a lot more million people than we have. But I feel like we can do a lot more. We can do better.
And I really, really do echo your sentiments. Mm. It's one of the reasons why I've started what I've started. Mm. And on that note, I want to say thank you. By this stage, anybody who's listening would have heard you at Suits mm-hmm. and Sneakers. So with that in mind, even though on the night I would have said thank you, I want to just say thank you again. Thank you for being part of it. Thank you for, you've come at a very interesting time for Suits and Sneakers. Mm-hmm. It's growing. And by now you would have had this opportunity, give or take 3,000 people. I couldn't get the whole room, but I got 3,000. I couldn't get the whole of South Africa, but I've got about 3,000 people.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's about 3,000 people. You would have had a chance to give them your best. So thank you for being part of it. I know the answer to this, but just for the sake of it, if people want to get hold of you, where do they follow you? What is your Twitter handle?
Okay, my Twitter handle is exactly like my Instagram handle, which is Khaya Dlanga, which is KHAYADLANGA.
Are you on Facebook?
That
do you like people? Do you like people following you on Facebook? They follow me. They do it anyway. Khaya, shot so much for your time. We're definitely coming back for a round two. I'm so excited that people get to hear the background story. If they didn't get it before, now they can search and scour the internet. Yeah. They won't find it, but they're going to hear it here. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being patient with us over the December break when we didn't release new material, but we're back in business and ready to have a go for the new year. I hope you enjoyed listening to Khaya's story. To be honest with you, the more I get to know him, the more I like everything that he's about. Before you all get going, I just want to give a special shout out to Word of Mouth and Kyle Word in specific, who gives of his time to help us put this podcast together. Do us a favor and go check him out and his company online and connect with the little bugger. And go see what he's all about. Then also do yourselves a favor and go and find Suits and Sneakers on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. These are the ways we love to keep in touch with you. And finally, if you like what we're doing, give us a shout on info@suitsandsneakers.co.za and leave us with your comments and thoughts. Until next week, have a cracker adventure.